witness each. 2415 has considerably more witnesses signed up, but the sponsor isn't here right now, and I want to wait. And anyway, it's not first on the agenda. So we'll start with the public hearing on 2363, Fred Merrill. President Mason has some affection for this bill.
Sorry.
Professor Merrill, what do you
think? My name is Fred Merrill. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon Law School and the executive director of the Council on Court Procedures. The reason I'm here is that the council has a strong interest in the area also, and on their agenda for things that they were going to do this year was to take care of facsimile service. The council is meeting on the 4th of March, and on the agenda is consideration of the bill, so I just wanted to inform the committee of that. It might be somewhat helpful to have their reaction. They haven't taken a position on it. The second thing is I have received calls from several individual council members relating to this bill, raising problems with hours in which service is possible. The two people that called me said they got served with papers in the middle of the night on their fax machines, and that created some problems for them, and asked that if there was going to be a service set up, that would it be possible to consider limiting the hours of service to normal business hours when one might have somebody available.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Mason.
One of the things that we've not put in the original bill, and I had this drafted, was the possibility of expanding it to courts. The court system's not taking a position on this, so I suspect they might be very interested to actually allow the filing of complaints by fax, combining that with the provisions allowing you to pay the fee with the credit card. Essentially, you just, and we'd allow it to rule the specifics, allow you to file the complaint and file your fee. I assume the cover letter, I leave that to better. What's your feeling on that?
I think the fax is going to take over the world, and we might as well deal with that. And I foresee tremendous transmissions of documents by facsimile, and certainly filing is not something. I think the council should and probably is going to consider the question of services summons by facsimile.
But I had not bold enough to go that far.
Right, there may be some real problems with that.
Yeah, but I might add that my original concern about complaint was the archival aspect of it, but then somebody pointed out to me that we don't keep paper now anyway, that we photograph these complaints eventually anyway, the day of microfiche is here, so as long as it can be photographed, device, and archival.
You'd like the original signed complaint, but I don't see that. You got a facsimile.
I'm curious about the limitation on business hours. I'm listening to fax taking over the world and wishing that I were an investment counselor, I guess. Maybe it's too late to be an investment counselor. Would you explain why this problem arises? It seems to me that if you arrive in your office at 8 o'clock in the morning and you've got some, and you've been served sometime during the night, that you certainly shouldn't be responsible for having had it between the hours of 5 and 8. But if it's arrived between the hours of 5 and 8 and it's sitting there, your machine having sort of just taken care of that for you the next day.
There has to be a cutoff somewhere.
So what you're saying is that the transmission after 5 o'clock would count as having been served. You're looking for some kind of language that counts that as having been served the following day.
No, I think the objection that was put to me, and again, I'm personally not sure where I come down on this, was that they didn't realize that they had been served. They didn't have a system set up to take care of things that came in other than normal business hours, and the way it was put to me is all these other forms of service, at least in a business sense, are something that can only take place during business hours. If it's mail, the mail will be delivered during business hours. If it's personally served or left with a person in the office, all that takes place during business hours, and that they were embarrassed because this thing had come in. Nobody knew it was there. They went in, I think it was a default situation, try to get a default on the basis they hadn't got service, and then were told that the thing had been served and went back to the office and it was there.
I suppose we will have a CLE on remembering to check your fax machine in the morning when you come in to work, because it sounds to me that it might be more reasonable, given this technology, to leave the machine on and available for receipt of service during the night when, if nothing else, cheaper time to use the phone line.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Manick.
Back, based in regard to what you just said, there's even there are devices put out to allow automatic delay until nighttime for transmission to save money for that reason, and so on and so forth. There's more and more of a tendency to use night service.
Representative Minnis.
What if your machine's broke? Did it not work then? I don't know anything.
The way the fax works is that if the machine is turned off or is disconnected, you can't get a transmission indication.
Mechanical difficulty would do the same thing?
Yeah.
Well, the bill requires that the device is operating.
Representative Edmondson.
Professor Merrill, I recall you describing to me years ago the mailbox rule. I think this bill probably appropriately may create a telephone rule, because the delivery of service to a machine is a little different than delivery of service to a person, and I'm wonder if you see any problems with the verification of actual service when it's received by a machine, and the affidavit is, of service is basically that the party has served it by transmitting it to a machine. It's a little different than handing a document to a party, a real live person that can be described later as a person over the age of 14 or something of that nature.
And which might raise problems with service of summons. Very different, but I think for this purpose, since you can mail it anyway and you're dependent on mail service, certainly the telephone company and the equipment is equally as reliable as mail. And I believe that you can tell on your end if the machine on the other end is working and received it. You get a confirmation. If it's mechanically down, if it's turned off, you have no evidence that you transmitted.
Madam Chairman?
If we could, let the members of the committee and you, Professor Merrill, know that I think what the process is here is that the committee has some questions that we would really like to have the Council on Court Procedures look at, so that when you return, we have a set over date to March 8th. We have received a large number of bills that Council and I are scheduling, and I'm ready to march on today with our next bill, if I'm not rolling over anyone, Representative Clark and Representative Mannix, with your indulgence, so that we can go to House Bill 2415, which has considerable witnesses signed up.
I was just going to make a request on this.
Sure.
And that is, perhaps we could have a representative of one of these companies come to explain to us some of the technological dynamics, too.
After we just have our own people here for the clerk's office.
That'd be great. Representative Clark is...
I just would like to ask the professor one question he can take with him and bring back, and that is there any reason to limit fax service to parties represented by attorneys?
Sure.
And that in the bill, I think I understand why you would, but I guess I'd like to ask you to rethink that.
I will put that in the hours to the council and see if I can get some kind of reaction. There may be something else other people see.
I just want to point out that of all the things we can do, there probably is more money saving to be had in this bill than about anything else we'll do, because I know that a lot of attorneys spend an immense amount of money on messenger services, about 4:30 every day.
Right.
Because that thing has to be there by 5. Also, a lot of money saved on Federal Express now. Federal Express, as they say those words, is probably looking for a lobbyist to kill this bill. But there's just a lot of money that could be saved here.
I think we may have some process servers in the room, actually, right? Thank you.
I will return on the 8th. Thank you very much.
465. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2363 and move along to House Bill 2465. Timothy Wood.
Great.
I mean, it's...
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Timothy Wood. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. What brings me before you this afternoon is that as an Assistant Attorney General, my primary responsibility falls in the field of financial fraud. That's not committing it. It is enforcing our financial fraud laws. And what we have brought before you this afternoon is a bill that would make the enforcement of these statutes somewhat easier. What I'd like to do for you as quickly as possible would be, number one, give you an idea of what the bill does, and number two, to tell you why we need the bill. There's really two parts to this bill. The first part is saying that when there is an agreement with the Oregon Department of Justice and a business, that they will do certain things for us, in particular, make restitution to a consumer, then the bill says that if they fail to make that restitution, then the agreement will have the same force and effect as a judgment order. The second part of the bill is that when we go out and we get an agreement with a business that they're going to do certain things for the state, and they fail to do it, then we take contempt action. And what the bill is asking you to do is say, okay, when we bring a contempt action, to make sure that we get attorney's fees in the event that we prevail. Now, why do we need it? What does this mean? How does this work? If I may, I'm just going to have to take a second and talk about the unlawful trade practice and what I characterize as the beauty of that statute. In Oregon, unlike many other states, when a business steps over the line and commits an unlawful trade practice, or the Attorney General believes the business has violated the unlawful trade practice, rather than loading our guns and firing a lawsuit at the business, the statute says, look, you come to the business and you say to them, would you like to work out an agreement with us where we'd say, look, we're not going to say you did anything wrong, but what you're going to do is promise in the future that you will comply with the unlawful trade practice. That's called an assurance of voluntary compliance, and that's all set out in the statute. Also, what happens a lot of times, let's assume we had like five senior citizens that were taken advantage of by a home remodeler. The home remodeler goes out, the home remodeler's not licensed, it tells the senior citizens that, look, you need furnace repair, where really they don't need any furnace repairs. And they say, okay, we made a mistake, we'll pay each one of these senior citizens $10,000. And we'll agree to do that, and we'll agree to do that in this agreement, this assurance of voluntary compliance, because we don't have any money now. We've spent it all. Well, what's happened is we then go out to enforce that gentleman's agreement, and we don't have an easy mechanism to enforce it. We could perhaps sue him for breach of contract. We've asked for confessions of judgment. That presents a problem in and of itself. But what we're saying is, look, allow us to have this assurance of voluntary compliance. By statute, it already gets filed with the court and recorded. Allow that person to say, okay, I'll take 90 days to pay you back. And in the event that the person fails to make the payment within a certain period of time, then it becomes a judgment. And that would give us the opportunity to go out and to execute, file a writ of attachment, to have a judgment lien on the individual's real property in the event that that person had any. We have an example of a case up in the city of Portland where there was an individual had a music store and was supposedly selling instruments and allowing these people to use the instruments for a lifetime. And I forget, there was consumers lost about $60,000 to $70,000. And this person said, okay, you got me. I made a mistake. I'll pay him back. Well, lo and behold, the person first month came and they didn't make payment. Second month came, didn't make payment. Well, now what do? We go out and file a lawsuit and start all over again? Or can you give us the authority to say, yes, that has the full force and effect of a judgment, therefore file a writ of attachment or have a lien on the person's property? As far as the second part of the statute, what happens is once they've entered into one of these agreements with us and they said, we'll be good, we won't be bad in the future, if they don't comply with it, one of our enforcement mechanisms is to ask that they be held in contempt of court. And we have had a limited amount of success in asking these individuals to be held in contempt. We've had great assistance from some of our circuit court judges who simply say, look, you are going to put that furnace back or you're going to spend the weekend in jail. And if we need to go to the contempt step level, what we're asking for is that the person then have to pay our attorney's fees and investigative costs. There's an issue out there as to whether we're already entitled to them, but we simply want to make it clear as a part of the legislation or the statutory scheme that when, in fact, we need to go to that next step where the person hasn't kept their agreement, that, in fact, we can get our attorney's fees in the event that we prevail. Now, I suppose one of the questions you might ask is, well, is there any opposition to this? Quite frankly, I've not had anyone call me. It's the sort of thing where it seems to me it'd be difficult to be opposed to it. It'd be difficult to say, yes, we agreed to make restitution to the victims, but we never intended to pay. And what we want is to have the Attorney General disarmed and make it more difficult in the event that the Attorney General wants to go out and actually require me to pay. And as far as the contempt go, once again, we're asking this person to be held in contempt because they've entered into an agreement with us. They're not complying with it. Now it costs the state additional money to pursue it, and we're asking for our attorney's fees in that event.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Clark.
Three questions. I see no provision in this bill that as you're entering into this agreement for assurance of voluntary compliance, that you advise defendant that this assurance of voluntary compliance will become a judgment. Pay, failed to follow through, and that there are magical consequences to the word judgment. All sorts of things happen when you phrase something as a judgment that don't happen when you have a voluntary compliance agreement, as evidenced by your being here asking us for the ability to go out and document this thing as a judgment. I'm just simply concerned that somebody be made very aware of the consequences up front, that not only do we have this agreement that we're getting ready to enter into with you, but you need to know that something magical happens to it if you don't follow through on it. It becomes a judgment, and then that gives us more power and more rights than we have the agreement itself. Do you have any problems with putting some sort of a notice provision in there?
I wouldn't have any problems with doing it. In fact, what we do now, if you looked at our form assurance, there are very serious consequences that flow from a person signing one of those, in that if they violate it and it's willfully violated, we can get a $25,000 penalty. So when we have the assurance of voluntary compliance, we put that provision in there. Interestingly enough, a lot of lawyers come in and negotiate and try to get it taken out. But we do put it in there saying, look, this is to tell you and to tell your client that if you willfully violate it, then it could cost you up to $25,000 for a willful violation of it. So no, I mean, one of the things in lawful trade practice is about full disclosure, and we'd be happy to make full disclosure if you wanted to come up with the language.
Question.
Go ahead.
Line 24, page 1 of the bill. Sorry, line 23, page 1 of the bill. Technical question. Should it not read that certified copy of the assurance shall be filed with the clerk of the court rather than may?
I think that's clearly the probably one of those things where may means shall. And
We're very precise here.
But that's put shell in there.
Yeah. Final question. As I look at section 2 of the bill, on page 2, the bottom language that you've added there, I don't see any place else in existing law where we reference a contempt action. And I realize that you have the inherent authority to apply to court for contempt any time there's a violation of court order. Do we, by making express reference to a contempt action here, are we giving you authority that you don't already have? I guess I just want to be clear on that for the record.
Representative Clark, if you look at 646, I think it's either 608 or 632, subsection 4. What it says is one of the enforcement mechanisms when an individual violates an assurance of voluntary compliance is that it may be enforced through the contempt process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Mason.
Back to Representative Clark's question about Shell versus May. Wouldn't this, if you say May, give you a certain amount of leverage, perhaps in negotiations, starting them, a little bit of a club, you know, either you clean up your act or we file this as a judgment?
I think it's interesting because so you're probably asking what the different results are. Representative Clark was asking if, before you can even enforce it, don't we need to mandate that you file it? You're asking the question, well, what if you don't want to file it? You don't want to mandate the Attorney General to file it either unless they want to have it as a judgment. And I'm not sure. I haven't looked at...
I have a comment on that.
No.
Yes, Representative Mannix might be able to shed some...
I think there's some language you could use that would do that. We were just had a little sidebar discussion here about the same thing. Someone may not want to file that ABC. They may want to just pay it right away and have it get behind them and not have it in the judgment records anyway. If you said on line 18, that's okay. If an approved, da-da-da-da-da. You go down to line 21, the assurance of voluntary compliance shall constitute a judgment in favor of the state of Oregon for the unpaid balance if a certified copy of the assurance along with a certificate stating the unpaid balance is filed with a clerk of court. So then you've got a judgment if you file it with the clerk, but you don't need to worry about filing it unless you're trying to get that judgment. I'll bring that up during work session, but I think the language can be modified to do that, but that may was a problem also because that was iffy.
Oh, I suppose this will come up at work session and...
I do have one other question though. I guess because I've been browbeaten on this by the courts for so long, we need to change the name of the assurance at the time that it becomes a judgment and slap a new piece of paper on the front of it and call it a judgment?
Put a summary of judgment on it?
Summary of judgment. I mean, there's no such thing as a judgment order. We know that now. There's no such thing as an order of judgment. There's only such this magical thing called a judgment. And I wonder if some of the other things we're doing in other areas procedure, you have this thing hanging out there in the records of the court called assurance of voluntary compliance, an unpaid balance on it. Does that do it? Does that make it a judgment?
Well, Representative Clark, Madam Chair, I think it's a good question. In fact, right now, quite frankly, I think when a lot of the circuit court clerks get these documents, assurances of voluntary compliance, I'm sure they look at them and say, what the heck is this animal? We submit it to the judge. Sometimes we have to describe it to the judge what it is, and then we show in the statute where it says this is what it is and gets filed with the court and et cetera. Whether we need to go to the next step now in light of the changes about a judgment, a summary of judgment, one of the nice things about appearing before a committee like this is that there are so many good minds that I'm sure can tell me what the answer to that is. I'm not sure what the answer is.
Neither am I.
So, you know, it seems to me, at least my argument, and the same thing with the assurance, would be the statute says what it says. And no committee can take that away. The fact of the matter is, whatever you want to call it, the fact of the matter is what the legislature has said is that the Attorney General can now go out and issue a writ of execution or have it attached to real property as a lien. Unless there was some other statute which would specifically overrule that, it seemed to me to be very difficult for that to an argument to prevail to say, no, you didn't have the summary of judgment.
I'm not concerned about your ability to go out and execute on this. I think this bill makes it very clear that you have the authority. I'm concerned about other people looking, judgment searches, that sort of stuff. Assurance of voluntary compliance kind of triggers that for somebody. I wonder whether we ought not go the approach of actually having the AG file an application for judgment.
The indication in here about the along with a certificate, perhaps that's what we do, play with that language there, and what we'd say along with a certificate which shall be duly captioned judgment.
That would satisfy my concern.
Mr. Wood, I have a question. Just in next step with this bill, did you drafting or work closely?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair.
willing to come back to conceptual amendments drafted so that as them, then you have an opportunity to run them by the other people, anyone who you choose.
I'd be happy to work with whomever on the committee, and my understanding is you need an LC draft too. So I'd be happy to work with LC, members of the committee, members of the Department of Justice.
I'm not so
anyone
worried.
Who's interested.
I'm not so worried about the form of an LC draft, because we can get it from here to LC before full committee with conceptual amendments, but I appreciate that. Representative Mason.
Well, I just was having a conversation with Representative about some of the other subtleties of it. And I was wondering, I'm uncomfortable with if these things do come into play in priority, I want to think about priority as priority. And some of those damnable bankruptcy situations in inevitable. All kinds of. Although I think it's a good bill, and I generally like the bill, but those of us who ever been through some bankruptcy law and first in time, first in right, and who had priority, who was secured, and who was unsecured, don't want to leave it out there kind of floating, but this could be a lot of money.
Yes, it could, and who you have to think about as a general rule, what we're looking at is victims. We're talking about consumers who've been taken advantage of. This case that I talked to you about in the city of Portland, it's an individual who left them hanging for about $60,000. Quite frankly, what he did was he immediately turned around when we started to get aggressive in enforcement and turned into bankruptcy court. There's going to be a question as to whether...
Again, I don't want to make Mr. Bonner uncomfortable, but that would raise a question about do this, Frank. About in that particular situation, you might want the thing the word's going to come out of my mouth. Might want to have the priority to go back to the original date of the ABC if somebody. That too much?
Well, not being a bankruptcy expert, Representative Mason, I think one of the things that happens in bankruptcy court is that regardless of, let me back up, with the exception of the real property, which we will have a lien attached to, we'll have had to actually execute on the property before we would have any sort of claim of priority lien. This is not meant to change any sort of prioritizing in the bankruptcy proceeding. It's meant to maintain the status quo. I guess I need a bankruptcy expert sitting next to me here when we start talking about first in time, et cetera, and what impact it's going to have.
Bankruptcy is one of those two areas of law that admiralty and bankruptcy that are like never lands for those of us who don't practice there. Lawyers who need to get in there.
Council's going to make a comment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we got into this issue in forfeitures in House Bill 2282, the our member from last Monday. And the doctrine you're talking about is relation back, where you would say that the judgment, as its effect on the record, would relate back to an earlier place in time. That wreaks havoc with the title industry, as they informed us on numerous occasions during the interim session. I know that if you had a relationship back doctrine, it could really throw the whole title industry, which in turn has a substantial impact upon the mortgage and lending industry.
Well, let's do this. We have other business in front of the committee today, and I recognize that everyone has an issue here. It sounds like there are several people who have issues here who aren't here, and I certainly hope that they are here when we hear the bill again. So that we don't have to guess on behalf of, Mr. Bronner is here, but we don't have to make representations for the title industry or financial institutions from this position. I think that they are perfectly sophisticated enough to take their own positions and present them to the committee. Do we have a date?
March 8th.
We will put this on for March 8th.
Madam Chair,
and
may I ask one general question about some idea on language, not specifics, see if we've got the drift here, so if we're playing with it later, we'll know, since Mr. Wood is here. just think for a moment. Don't even read along because you'll get confused if you read it. But what if it said, if an approved assurance of voluntary compliance provides for the payment of an amount of money as restitution or otherwise, and if the amount is not fully paid within 90 days of the date the court approves the assurance, or within the dates specified in the assurance of voluntary compliance, because you might have a payment plan someday.
Different than before.
Or within the dates specified in the assurance for voluntary compliance, then the assurance of voluntary compliance may constitute a judgment in favor of the state of Oregon for the unpaid balance. A judgment may be established if a certified copy of the assurance along with a judgment certificate and a certificate stating the unpaid balance is filed with the clerk of the court for entry in the judgment docket within 1 year of the date the assurance of voluntary compliance is approved. And the reason I wanted to ask you about this is I found in about three things here. One is Representative Clark's requirement that you have some certificate saying judgment for the court's convenience. Another is Representative Baum's suggestion that what if you had a payment plan that covers a year? And the third is I'm concerned about having some time limitation on when Department of Justice can file a document